Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Boy, there's so much to talk about. So, of course, we reached out to the West Coast to our own Tim Miller. Thanks for coming back on the podcast, Tim.
Hey, Charlie. Fun as always. Let's do it.
Okay, well, let's start with the news over the weekend. Justin Amash puts out a tweet thread where he basically says, look, his principal conclusions are Attorney General Barr deliberately misrepresented the Mueller report. President Trump has engaged in impeachable conduct. Partisanship has eroded our system of checks and balances. Few members of Congress have read the report, fully embracing impeachment. And of course, as you know, the trolls and the flying monkeys have been leashed on him. He has a primary. He has a primary opponent. And the president of the United States felt it necessary to attack this this congressman as a total lightweight and loser. So what is Justin Amash up to? Is this the beginning of something, or is he an outlier?
Just brief aside, I have to do this because we're all just so numbed to the fact that you just sort of casually stated that the president of the United States took to Twitter to call a congressman a loser and a lightweight.
Yeah. A congressman, like, of his own party.
Right? Yeah. Just like, are we
from Michigan?
You know, I feel like if you just went back in a little time capsule, only like, I don't know, 40 months or so, this would be wildly condemned, wildly inappropriate. It's just, you know, the whole if Obama did a game gets tired. But, you know, it's for me, I just like to remind folks to just step back and talk and think about how, you know, inappropriate this is. But anyway, as regards to Amash, he's always been, you know, somebody who, you know, whatever, dances to the beat of his own drummer, whatever that cliche is. And, you know, it's funny. I've been thinking even before this tweet storm, you know, for the last several months, I've been like, who is it in Congress that I'm most aligned with these days, since everybody got along with, you know, got in line with Trump, you know, pretty much uniformly in the party. And it might really be Amash, which is funny because, you know, I've always been sort of a George W. Bush quasi neoconservative, not, you know, not a doctrinaire libertarian by any means. But, you know, in a number of ways, Amash and I would have, you know, butted heads in the past. But what has been unique about him is that no matter who's been in office, he has not been encumbered by partisan requirements. And sometimes that's meant that he's been to the right of the party. Sometimes it's meant that, in this case, I guess I wouldn't call it left, but, you know, outside of the party.
He's definitely not a team player. I think it's fair to say not a team player.
And it hasn't been, you know, on, you know, opportunistic grounds, right? It's been, he is a guy, this is his worldview, he's a doctrinaire libertarian. If you go outside of his worldview, doesn't matter whose party you are, he's going to criticize you, he's going to vote against you. And frankly, it's really refreshing to me. And we could use, it's kind of crazy to think that with 435 people over there in the House, there's only like one or two or three, maybe there are a couple others who act like this, who just sort of separate themselves from, you know, what the party obligations are, what the, you know, partisan media obligations are on their side, and just vote with how they are. And that's in line with voters, really. I mean, you know, most voters are heterodox on issues. So anyway, Amash is very interesting on that front. And I think it gives him opportunities like this to stand out from the pack and to say some pretty obvious things about the Mueller report that you guys have talked about on this podcast, you know, a bunch already, just about how, you know, wildly inappropriate, you know, a lot of the activities that were laid out.
Well, beyond inappropriate, actually impeachable. Okay, so look, I think some people have seized upon this as, okay, we finally have a Republican who's gotten out on this. But, of course, it is Justin Amash. And so
I think that's a nice talking point for the DNC. Probably not a
trendsetter.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's a trendsetter at all. I'd be surprised if there were any other Republicans.
So given that, the fact that he is not a trendsetter, he is an outlier. And people who know who he is understand all of that. why the heavy hammer being dropped on him? You know, going back to the point about the president of the United States, you have, you know, Kevin McCarthy, you know, talking about this as some sort of a bizarre exit strategy for Amash. If in fact it's just one guy, why bother to drop the house on him?
Well, it was the first article I wrote for The Bulwark. Was called "The President is a Special Snowflake" or something to that effect. And that's why. Trump is, you know, the most emotionally needy person in public life today. He does not like being criticized. There's this sort of myth about him that he's like, whatever, this tough guy, that he's a tough fighter and, you know, wants to take on the... That's not true. If he could be loved by everybody, trust me, that would be the card that he would pull. And so that's why. And McCarthy, and then the reason for McCarthy is that's the best way to suck up to him. You know, if somebody's mean to the president and you attack the mean person, president notices it and, you know, you get whatever benefits that these people think that they are getting from this attention, you know, invites to the White House, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so let me play this soundbite.
Sure.
Mitt Romney, Senator Mitt Romney, was on CNN on Sunday morning, and he brings up Justin Amash's endorsement of impeachment, but very clearly is not prepared to go along with. And this is what he had to say.
My own view is that Justin Amash has reached a different conclusion than I have. I respect him. I think it's a courageous statement. But I believe that to make a case for obstruction of justice, you just don't have the elements that are evidenced in this document. And I also believe that an impeachment call is not only something that relates to the law, but also considers practicality and politics. And the American people just aren't there. And I think those that are considering impeachment have to look also at the jury, which would be the Senate. The Senate is certainly not there either.
Okay, well, he's obviously right that the votes are not there in the Senate. But it is interesting. I mean, there's Mitt Romney calling Justin Amash courageous, but basically saying, yeah, but I'm not. So, I mean, isn't that what is that? I mean,
this is Mitt. This is Mitt, Charlie. I have a soft spot for Mitt. I went against him in two primaries, and he honestly grew on me over the course of the two primaries. He's a moral person, a principled person, but a cautious one. And so he's going to go. He's not going to unnecessarily put himself out there if he doesn't think that there is a realistic end game. And so that's why he, you know, this whole kind of Romney in the Senate. Gambit was just set up to disappoint everyone, right? He's never gonna the never Trumpers are never gonna be happy enough with how hard he goes against Trump. And I'm in that category. I wish he'd pick a couple specific things and really be a dog and a bone on them. But that's not Mitt. And the Republican types, the Trumpers, are never gonna be happy because he's gonna call Justin Amash courageous, right? And so, you know, I think that's why he is actually out of the news a lot, you know, frankly, when you consider his stature and focus more on a Utah audience.
Okay, now this is a very interesting question. You know, given his stature, given his age, he's in the United States Senate. What does he have to lose? Why wouldn't he have a higher profile, except that the Republican Party has so completely basically given itself over to Trump that there's no place for him, that there's no traction.
Yeah, now we're getting to putting Mitt on the couch because I don't know. I'm with you on this. There is nothing to lose. I feel that way about not only just Mitt, but there are other Republicans, people who are, you know, term limited out, people who are, you know, in blue states, don't have future career. Why aren't there more people taking this opportunity to use a platform, use their bully pulpit to really hone in? I think that the Mueller report opportunity is there. I think there was a news last week about how Trump, you know, made $40 million from the hotel in D.C., which is, you know, all from foreign governments and interest groups. I mean, this is a direct violation of the law. That is something that Mitt could go out there with. That's not an ideological thing that's going to get him misaligned with the party. And he could go out there and be a very prominent leader that holds the president to account and draws more attention to this. That's just not him. And I probably go to my grave wondering why more Republicans haven't taken this opportunity. To me, it seems like a no-brainer. But
or just pick some. You could say, I'm going to vote for all your judges. I'm going to vote for all your bills.
Right.
But you know, if there's a report that Deutsche Bank was looking the other way when you were engaging in possibly money laundering, I would like to know more about that. But in the current environment, you can't question them at all. Let me bounce this off you and see what you think. I mean, and this sort of struck me, you know, as the Amash thing blew up over the weekend, that with the exception of that, it seems pretty obvious that the Democrats are losing the momentum on this. They're losing the messaging war. The Republicans appear to be really on the offensive and emboldened in not only brushing off the Mueller report, brushing off the evidence of conspiracies and obstruction of justice, but really going on the offensive to turn it around, like, we're going to investigate the FBI. And that appears to be, you know, the state of play right now. And the Democrats just kind of seem like flailing around.
Totally agree. I don't get it. There's this theory that, like, they're on the left that you know, Pelosi and her allies have put forth that's like, you know, we're not going to impeach him anyway, so what is the point? But I guess I would extend that same analogy then to everything that the House is doing, right? Because it's not like the legislation they're passing is getting taken up by Mitch McConnell and, you know, there's some bipartisan comedy that's happening. So I don't, you know, whether impeachment is a vehicle or not, I'm really flabbergasted that the Democrats are missing a huge opportunity to basically use the next year to put him on trial, you know, to do Deutsche Bank, to do emoluments, to look. Yeah,
this is not normal. I'm glad you used that word flabbergasted, because I've gone from being, you know, kind of furrowed-browed, being a little, concerned and understanding the need to be nuanced, to like, guys, what are you doing? This is an incredible opportunity. Do you not understand the role that you can play in educating the public and moving public opinion? You know, public opinion polls are not set in concrete. They can actually be, you know, people's opinions can change. By the way, here's something you probably haven't seen yet from Columbia Business School. I don't know if you saw that new research showing what polls missed in 2016, they found people who kept their vote secret, so sort of the shy Tory type thing. And what a surprise, they did a study of 1,000 voters who basically didn't tell anyone who they were voting for. They voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump, in overwhelmingly, because they were concerned about their reputation and fitting in. Mm-hmm. Obviously, sort of a challenge there. So, yeah. So Democrats, once again, are reminding us that they can often be really bad at politics.
Yeah. Look, and let's just look at the political implications of how the Republicans handled Benghazi. Right. We could do a whole other podcast on, you know, the merits of Benghazi. But the political implications, I mean, Gowdy and et al. Were merciless on Hillary on this. There were hearings after hearings. They were criticized by, you know, the mainstream media and the left is like, this is so going overboard. There's, you know, the Republicans are overstepping. There's going to be a backlash. How did that turn out? No backlash. What it did was it tarnished Hillary. And now the Democrats
badly,
have this opportunity
right.
badly to do the same thing on, you know, what I think some would rightly argue is a lot more credible, you know, and merited issues to do this, to do that sort of investigation on. And they seem to be doing it very haphazardly, if at all. And like, is there even a investigation on Trump on emoluments? And have they even tried to look into the business records? I don't think so. You have to imagine that would show something that would be damaging to him.
No, this is a really important point. I mean, first of all, that investigation uncovered the whole Hillary email issue.
Correct.
You also had some classic sound bites that came out of this. You know, at this point, what difference does it make? It really, really, really stuck with her. And people forget how high her approval rating was when she was Secretary of State, and how public opinion really turned on her, not just over Benghazi. Obviously, there were a lot of things that were going on here, but that would be a perfect example, which apparently Democrats have completely forgotten about. Okay, so speaking of presidential politics, I don't know whether you and I spoke about this, but the whole question of whether there was a sister soldier moment possibly out there, and I bring that up knowing that the sister soldier dates to 1992, so 90% of our audience probably doesn't even remember it. But I did think that Mayor Pete and Joe Biden had little mini sister soldier moments. Let's start with Joe Biden, who's kicking off his campaign in Philadelphia, and very specifically pushes back against this idea that the Democrats want an angry person and sort of positions himself as, hey, you know, let's bring together the coalition of the decent. Let's actually have some unity. And this is what he said over the weekend.
I know some of the really smart folks say Democrats don't want to hear about unity. They say Democrats are so angry that the angry candidate can be the better chance he or she has to win the Democratic nomination. Well, I don't believe it. I really don't. If Democrats, I believe Democrats want to unify this nation. That's what our party's always been about. It's always been about unity. If the American people want a president to add to our division, lead with a clenched fist, a closed hand, a hard heart, to demonize your opponent, to spew hatred. They don't need me. They got President Donald Trump. I'm ready to go for our country, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, a different path. Not back to a path that never was, but to a future that fulfills our true potential as a country.
I thought that was pretty interesting that he's willing to stand up knowing that all of the wins on the Democratic Party are for, you know, the angriest possible liberal, boldest AOC type proposal. And he's saying, hey, I'm not that guy. I'm not that guy.
Yeah, I think it was David Drucker I saw who tweeted this and said basically that say what you know what about Biden. He is so far running as the best version of himself. Right. That he is, you know, that he is running, is taking his strengths and he's maximizing them. And it's in a field that's very, you know, fractured. And so sort of the inverse of this happened in the Republican side. Right. Where Trump was, you know, sort of the one that was, you know, going away from the way the crowd was moving, which was more to the sort of ideologically true con, if you will, you know, kind of position on everything. And Trump, you know, went against that in some ways with, you know, some more liberal positions on you know, and entitlements, and then in other ways by just being willing to, you know, say racist stuff. But, you know, Biden has a similar opportunity, right, where everybody is running one to the ball, and, you know, he is taking on this huge portion of kind of center-left voters, some voters of color, you know, who aren't, you know, in aren't very online and up to speed on what the mandatory position is as dictated by The Intercept on every issue. And it's working for him so far. Will it continue? I don't know. I definitely think that there is a big portion of the Democratic base, if it was a, you know, two-way race, that does want somebody that's angry and is going to fight. But I think it's an open question about whether that's, you know, a majority or, you know, or whether Trump or Biden can get a plurality of voters who this does resonate with. Or, and this is really underrated, voters who want to fight and want to take Trump down that are practical. And they're saying, I want to take him down, but I actually just want this guy out of my life. And whoever is the most likely to do it, I'm going to be with. And so they're just channeling their anger in a different way. And Biden's doing a nice job of sort of coalescing those.
No, I have to admit, I'm surprised and at least tentatively impressed by his launch and the numbers that he's putting up. I mean, just the overwhelming lead, not overwhelming, but I mean, the very, very strong lead among Democrats. But then the numbers that came out last week showing him with a double digit lead in Pennsylvania over Donald Trump. And I think that has got to be his one of his strongest selling points. Look, this election is going to be decided in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and here's the guy that is actually playing very, very well there. What also strikes me, by the way, and I'm sure you've noticed this as well, is watching the media narrative change on certain candidates. I mean, Beto O'Rourke went from being, this is the guy who's going to be, you know, first of all, he's on the cover of Vanity Fair, you know, and he was the great liberal hope, the future of the Democratic Party, to what a lightweight loser. And also watching the tone of the coverage of Bernie Sanders start to change as well. The, you know, you're a cranky old man who has weird ideas, and you're starting to see late night talk show hosts make fun of him. And the New York Times people writing articles about, you know, his crazy pro-Sandinista, pro-Soviet past. And so those narratives have turned kind of sour, haven't they?
And just really quick, yeah, the inverse of that with Biden, you know, as a former Jeb guy, you know, when I was making the rounds around Biden's announcement, every reporter, every question was like, isn't Biden Jeb?
Right.
Isn't Biden Jeb again? Biden's Jeb. I couldn't talk to a reporter without that question being raised. And, you know, and I was always offered you know, the advantages that Biden had that Jeb didn't. And now here we are, what, 3 weeks later, a month later? And you don't hear that nearly as much anymore. He's shown a resiliency in the face of, you know, kind of the sniff gate, a hair sniffing gate. And, you know, then sort of there was this onslaught of New York Times stories with, you know, old, you know, votes and comments of his from the 80s that, you know, his opponents were planting around the announcement. And he, you know, has shown a lot of armor to that. And that has affected his press coverage. You hear a lot less of the, you know, skepticism in comparing him to, you know, Wesley Clark and Jeb and people who have lost in the past.
So let's get to Mayor Pete. Now, you've written about Mayor Pete in the past, and I think your essay about that moment, the kiss, is still, I think, one of the most interesting and widely discussed pieces that we run on the Bulwark. But over the weekend, Mayor Pete did something that Elizabeth Warren refused to do. He went in on a town hall on Fox News. Okay, yes, it was opposite Game of Thrones. So, but, well, and I thought one of the more striking things that he said, though, was when he was addressing why he went on Fox News. But he also, you know, I said this is where the voters are. But then he also takes a very pointed shot at Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham. Let's play that soundbite.
You know, a lot of folks in my party were critical of me for even doing this with Fox News.
I've heard that.
and I get where that's coming from, especially when you see what goes on with some of the opinion hosts on this network. I mean, when you got Tucker Carlson saying that immigrants make America dirty, when you've got Laura Ingraham comparing detention centers with children in cages to summer camps, then there is a reason why anybody has to swallow hard and think twice before participating in this media ecosystem. But I also believe that even though some of those hosts are not always there in good faith, I think a lot of people tune into this network who do it in good faith. And there are a lot of Americans who my party can't blame if they are ignoring our message, because they will never hear it if we don't go on and talk about it. And so it's why, whether it's going into the viewership of Fox News or whether geographically it's going into places where Democrats haven't been seen much, I think we got to find people where they are, not change our values, but update our vocabulary so that we're truly connecting with Americans from coast to coast.
All right, Mayor, we got to take a break here.
Okay, you know, you have a piece up about the Bulwark yesterday where you said this shows why Democrats need Fox News to win the White House, and it's a better strategy than calling half the country deplorables.
Well, yeah, low bar, I guess, on that I set up for Pete. You know, look, you're scoring on the points in the Democratic primary. You know, one day, one news cycle, point to Pete. You know, he went on Fox. He showed that he actually wants to engage with this audience. You know, what I focused on in my piece is that sometimes we get lost in all the takes and all the fog from the outrages of what exactly it is that we're doing here. And you're running for president to win and to have a governing coalition, not to make a point. And so, you know, if Media Matters wants to boycott Fox, that's one thing. They're liberal activists, that they have a different objective. They're not trying to win the White House. But when Elizabeth Warren does that, I wonder what is she getting out of that that's going to help her win?
Oh, I don't think she's thinking about that. I mean, she's just thinking about I'm the angriest. I'm angrier than Bernie Sanders. I wouldn't go where Bernie goes.
Pete demonstrated, I think, the value of his strategy vis-a-vis Warren's. He went on Fox. He demonstrated to the viewers that were watching, you know, maybe the older set that wasn't into Game of Thrones, I don't know, that he does care about their vote, even though they probably aren't going to agree on a bunch of issues. You know, he took a whack at Fox so that, you know, he got the headlines he wanted on the lefty websites about how he went into the lion's den and took on Tucker and Laura. And then this morning, Drudge Report headline is, you know, Pete gets ovation and
that,
Trump
that
sees
was interesting.
Or
that was an interesting so he, that's the way it was. Yeah. That's the way it played on Drudge. So that matters.
Yeah. So in a competitive, in a 27,000 way primary, you know, when everybody's fighting for conversation share, Pete has a lot of conversation around that appearance today, mostly positive. And, you know, Warren is invisible. So I think that it shows. And, you know, look, I think a lot of times people think about this the wrong way. The question is the main Fox News viewer even going to vote for the Democrat? No, probably not. But Hillary only lost by 75,000 votes in three states. So now you're trying to take never Hillary voters. We all know them. you know, and take those never Hillary voters and move them maybe off of Trump and onto third party or onto staying at home or onto Howard Schultz, or maybe take people that voted for Evan McMullen or Gary Johnson last time because they just couldn't swallow Hillary and move them into the Democratic camp. Yes. A couple hundred thousand of those people, you know, which is 1% of the party, you know, makes you the president, whether you're Biden or Pete or somebody else. So strategically thinking about it that way, I think, you know, makes it, you know, a much more logical move, you know, than, you know, sort of, you know, painting with a broad brush.
You know, pointed out, look, all you just need to move 2 or 3 points and the reelect numbers for Donald Trump changed dramatically. But you're talking about, you know, 0.001% of the electorate that they could do. OK, so one of the things that Mayor Pete had to do, and there's been some. I think some hand-wringing about this, that he was portrayed as the more moderate, reasonable candidate, but he's been taking positions that certainly do not sound moderate. On abortion, for example, he's pretty much into that last trimester, you know, checking off that box. And then there was that controversy about something he said on the Hugh Hewitt radio show, where it sounded like he was for scrubbing Thomas Jefferson out of history. So what was that about?
Yeah, look, just very quickly on Pete's ideology. He's a progressive. There's just no doubt about it. He's moderate tonally. You know, he's moderate in the way that he wants to, you know, be uniting. You know, bring us back to a uniting country. He's moderate in the sense that, like, he'll throw. You know, he appreciates the military and you know, he cares about paying for, you know, your proposals, right? Some very basic things. But if you look at an issue set, he's on the left, and that's true on abortion. And for a lot of people, that's going to be a problem with him, no doubt. The Jefferson thing is a different example. And this is where you get into the question about should these guys do it at all, where there's at least some defense of not dealing with some of the bad faith actors on the right. Because the Hugh Hewitt interview, whatever you think about Hugh, was fascinating. It was a very fair interview. Hugh asked him a lot about bio and foreign policy. I'd recommend listeners go check it out. But he asked him about changing Jefferson Jackson dinners. And Pete, being kind of a nerd, did a 3-minute response about, you know, Jefferson and how in his letters he knew slavery was wrong and said, as a party, when they're considering this, maybe they shouldn't be honoring that. Maybe they should find a person of color to honor instead. And he specifically said in that answer that I don't think that we should be erasing history, you know, and you know, taking him out of, you know, the other sorts of monuments. But the Laura Ingrams of the world, the Daily Callers of the world, you know, went out and you know, made it seem like he wanted to, you know, change the Jefferson Memorial to
Twitter mobs and.
Yeah, and so he addressed that on the show, and I thought did a pretty good job. He kind of, I think, had Chris Wallace chuckling. He made a joke about how he was going to, you know, Laura Ingram was, you know, acting as if he's going to blow up the Jefferson Memorial or something. But, you know, this is where I think he is better than the other candidates on the left in a lot of ways, because he can take these moments. He's deft enough to get off talking points, you know, to speak like a normal human, to handle. And I think the last time I was on your podcast, I mentioned how he was asked about boycotting Chick-fil-A. And he's like, that's ridiculous. I like Chick-fil-A. They take good chicken. You know, he's able to take these sort of cultural moments, you know, where a lot of these other lefties are too scared to say anything that might offend, you know, the woke, you know, left social media mob. And it's sort of and he's been more deft to date at kind of navigating that. And I think the Jefferson was a good example.
I've said this before. I think he's the most interesting candidate, but he's not going to be the Democratic nominee, is he? And the reason I would say something that definitive is looking at some of those early numbers out of South Carolina where he gets 0% of the black vote. You cannot be the Democratic nominee with no support in the black community.
Unlikely. Here's your argument for Pete, and real is Iowa and New Hampshire, right? You know, there aren't a whole lot of black voters in Iowa and New Hampshire if you haven't been, and so you know you can pick up steam and gain momentum from winning those primaries and sort of seem like a winner, and there's a bandwagon effect, and that's really his only path. Because you're right, if you get into a, you know, long protracted, you know, battle where you are fighting out, you know, kind of delegate counts, and he's going against somebody like Biden or somebody like Kamala, you know, who will have a more natural base with voters of color on the left. It will be a really tough tough slog. But, you know, I guess I wouldn't be as definitive as you because of the Iowa.
No, you just wonder, effect. You know, what a lot of these guys who are running are positioning themselves for. And whatever happens with him, he's got a future. I mean, you probably saw what Joe Scarborough, who was I think went a little far, was saying. You know, I've seen the future of the Democratic Party, and it's Mayor Pete. Okay, that's fine. But
if I was Pete, I'd be calling Joe and be like, can you tone it down a little bit here? I mean, you were for Trump last time. I don't know that you're helping.
Yeah, that's
me,
we're putting that in the memory hole, aren't we? Tim Miller, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast, and your piece is really a must read about Mayor Pete. Why Democrats are smart actually to go on Fox News and the way he handled himself on all of that. And I agree with you. I think this, people look back on this after the campaign, you know, Elizabeth Warren thinking that this was a good move, short term maybe, but I don't think she's got the best political instincts. I just think, you know, and all the policy wonkery, I don't think is going to compensate for her lack of political instincts. So, Tim, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Anytime, Charlie. We agreed a little too much this time.
Absolutely.
Let's fight next time.
I'm in for that. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.